us, and we broke this story on Friday, why then he also did not present, why he presented Kenneth Walker hitting or firing the shot that hit Mattingly as inconclusive as well. He said in the press conference that it's because the bullet that was recovered was a 9mm. But the difference between a 9mm and what is normally shot with a 40 caliber weapon is very, very small. And the bullet was mangled. So we believe that it's inconclusive and that the public deserves more information to understand what we know for sure and what we don't and why things
have been presented the way they have been. Roberta Ferdman, I want to say thank you so much. We're going to continue to follow this. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Do you believe in the importance of community radio?
Of course I do.
Then show your support today by donating online at kboo.fm and help us meet our fall fundraising goal of $80,000. We can only get there through the support of people like you. So donate at kboo.fm or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Give a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member today. Thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, after the Proud Boys rally in Portland, police returned to a familiar and violent approach to Black Lives Matter protesters. Funding for the Student Success Act has been greatly reduced due to effects of the coronavirus pandemic, and Donald Trump nominates federal judge Amy Coney Barrett to fill the Supreme Court seat made vacant by the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 28th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Nat Moon. Dueling rallies on Saturday ended with few injuries, yet evening Black Lives Matter protests were met with excessive violence from police under unified command. On Friday, ahead of a far-right rally organized by the historically violent Proud Boys, Governor Brown declared a state of emergency to free up resources for addressing possible violence. The executive order placed Oregon State Police and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office as unified command over Portland Police for the weekend. While the order provided additional officers and resources for responding to potential violence, it also gave Portland police freedom to employ methods of crowd control they were previously not allowed to use. Around 50 officers from the Portland Police Bureau were deputized as federal marshals, meaning measures to keep them in check were temporarily lifted. Last week, Mayor Ted Wheeler announced a ban on the use of the tear gas, CS gas, by the Portland Police Bureau. The deputization of Portland police meant the ban no longer applied to them. The same goes for the temporary restraining order signed by a federal judge to protect legal observers and press from police violence. Saturday's rallies took place in North Portland, where a heavy police presence monitored around 300 Proud Boys and far-right demonstrators at Delta Park, along with over 1,500 counter-protesters at nearby Vanport and Peninsula Parks. Police response to the groups was unbalanced, to say the least. Caravans arriving from Vancouver Mall, including large trucks without license plates and people riding in the back, received a police escort into Delta Park, where days earlier group organizers were denied a permit for the event due to coronavirus policies. The permit cited 20,000 attendees when current regulations allow for groups no larger than 50 people. Actual turnout to the event was quite small, with most crowd estimates at about 300 people, far from the tens of thousands organizers predicted. Groups of armed right-wing demonstrators set up security checkpoints within the park, flouting Oregon's open carry laws within view of multiple police officers. A delivery of shields was made by American Wolf, a historically violent group of agitators known to wield paintball guns, mace, and zip ties in the name of peacekeeping. There was also an RV appearing to serve as a mobile armory, with unarmed men entering and armed men exiting throughout the event. Meanwhile, at nearby Peninsula Park, at least one counter-protester was arrested while unloading shields from a vehicle. According to witnesses, the officer who detained them said shields were not allowed. Multiple members of the press were threatened and assaulted by rifle-carrying militia types while attempting to cover the Delta Park rally. Video footage shows one journalist being shoved to the ground and kicked in the head, leading to a concussion. Despite heavy police presence, there was no police intervention. Hours later, police announced they were looking into the incident. At Peninsula Park, counter-protesters listened to speeches, enjoyed mutual aid and pizza, and took turns hugging Cesar, the no-drama llama. The counter-protest that began at Vanport caravaned to Irving Park, where speeches were given by Black members of the community. Other than attacks on press and the occasional counter-protester, events at Delta Park remained far less violent than anticipated. After 2 hours of speeches, weapons waving, and interviews with approved press, the caravan left the park. One truck of demonstrators was detained, with police citing a lack of a license plate as the reason, though most of the remaining unlicensed vehicles passed police without incident, with a wave and the occasional peace sign from police officers. Police listed firearms, baseball bats, paintball guns, and shields as items confiscated in the traffic stop. It was later Saturday night that the violence really began, and most, if not all of it, was done by Governor Brown's Unified Police Force. Video from Saturday's Black Lives Matter demonstration downtown shows police shoving and beating multiple members of press and the community as they appear to be following dispersal orders. Many seasoned protesters said they had never seen violence like that before. Police reports say protesters threw rocks at officers. There were 30 arrests Saturday night. Because Portland police were deputized, charges against those arrested will carry federal penalties. One video shows officers violently arresting people playing basketball in the street. In another video, an Uber delivery driver is tackled off his bike as he tries to cycle past. The violence prompted rapid condemnation from leaders in the civil rights community. Governor Brown lifted the emergency order on Sunday. She tweeted thanking the police for, quote, your professionalism and preventing violence. Over the weekend, the Oregon Health Authority reported 519 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of known cases up to 32,820. Oregon health officials also reported 5 more deaths over the weekend, raising the state's death toll to 547 people. On Monday, state health officials reported 181 new cases of COVID-19 in Oregon and 0 new deaths. Lane County had the highest number of new cases on Monday with 26, followed by Washington County with 24 and Multnomah County with 21. Nationally, as of Monday afternoon, more than 7.1 million people in the United States have been infected with COVID-19. At least 204,000 people have died across the country. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 33.2 million people in nearly every country. At least 998,000 people have died. When the Student Success Act was passed in 2019, it was described as historic, unprecedented, and 20 years overdue. The funding package was supposed to give $2 billion to schools across Oregon for things like smaller class sizes and mental and behavioral health supports, such as hiring additional counselors and improvements to school safety. The Student Success Act is funded through a corporate activities tax of 0.57% on businesses making more than $1 million. The most significant portion of the package was the $472 million fund for the K-12 student investment account that was slated to go directly to districts. However, the COVID-19 pandemic has caused business revenue to fall and tax revenue along with it. The student investment account, previously expected to have $472 million, decreased to just $150 million. Portland Public Schools was slated to receive $39 million, but after two rounds of cuts by legislators, will receive just $13 million. The director of the Oregon Department of Education, Colt Gill, called the reduction in funding a temporary setback and said they will continue with many parts of the plan. The New York Times obtained Trump's tax returns showing chronic loss and debts coming due, and Judge Amy Coney Barrett is Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court. With more on those stories, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
We've been negotiating for a long time. Things get settled, like in the IRS, but right now, when you're under audit, you don't do it. You don't do that.
That's President Trump explaining why he's still refusing to disclose his tax returns. The New York Times reports that Trump's facing a 10-year legal battle with the IRS over a $72.9 million tax refund he received. Reviewing decades worth of records, the Times concludes the president paid no income tax at all in 10 of the 15 years before he took office, and less than $1,000 each in 2016 and 17, with deep and chronic losses and massive debt coming due. Trump refutes the information. This week, he nominated Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. She's a devout Catholic with 3 years' experience on the bench.
If the Senate does me the honor of confirming me, I pledge to discharge the responsibilities of this job to the very best of my ability. I love the United States, and I love the United States Constitution.
Since Trump appointed her to the 7th District Court, she's reportedly voted to restrict abortion rights twice, despite writing that Catholic judges should recuse themselves on cases involving the death penalty or abortion. If confirmed, she would bring to the court a 6-3 conservative majority. Democratic fundraisers reported a surge after Ginsburg's death, so did multiple voter registration groups. Former Vice President Joe Biden urged voters to lobby their senators to fulfill the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's last words that the next president make the nomination.
The American people understand the urgency of this moment. They're already voting in droves because they know their health care hangs in the balance.
Senate Republicans plan the fastest confirmation in U.S. history, televised hearings starting in a couple weeks with a vote just days before the election. Shan Wu is a former federal prosecutor and a CNN legal analyst.
They're anticipating that, like Bush versus Gore, this election result may end up in court. And so they're hoping to find a court composition that will more easily rule in favor of the Trump candidacy.
In 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court stopped a recount in Florida, which could have put former Vice President Al Gore in the White House. Law professor Michael Morley at Florida State University predicts more challenges in key swing states.
The most likely scenario for Supreme Court involvement is tight margin in the Electoral College, where the outcome in one or two states would swing the results, and the difference is potentially coming down to a particular group of disputed ballots.
Both the Trump and Biden campaigns have massive legal teams. And tomorrow, Fox News' Chris Wallace moderates the first presidential debate at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The farm crisis of the 1980s and subsequent manufacturing losses fueled a flight from rural communities in some states. Groups calling for change say current political leaders are not tuned in to the concerns raised by people still living in those areas. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
In the coming weeks, political candidates will fan out in rural America, promising voters that struggling communities will get federal help. But in states such as Iowa, some say those pledges don't result in real investment and that a new approach is needed. Matt Hildreth of the group Rural Organizing argues that practices such as agriculture bailouts often result in subsidizing large ag companies while squeezing out smaller farm operations. That's why the group says a National Office of Rural Prosperity is needed to focus on how federal appropriations are divvied up for rural areas and make sure they go to the right place.
Right now, when you look at the federal government, the rural programs are through USDA, they're through HUD, they're through all these different agencies, and there's really no unified central force that's focused on keeping rural dollars rural.
The group's recent polling of more than 7,000 rural battleground voters found that only 1 in 10 think USDA programs benefit small farms and towns. Defenders of these bailouts say they bring stability during uncertain market conditions for farmers who are trying to keep the nation's food supply from running out. John Norris of Iowa State Public Policy Group says no one wants to diminish the role farmers play in supporting their communities. But he says in the Hawkeye State, there are important structural issues that need attention in rural areas.
Still broadband pockets and lack of high-speed internet. You've got the rural schools that are underfunded and don't have the course offerings that a lot of the other parts of the country do. You've got rural hospitals that are just hanging on.
And Hildra says investing in these areas could stop the bleeding when it comes to population loss in small towns.
Too many people feel like they have to leave to be successful. And I think an Office of Rural Prosperity will ensure that those economic opportunities exist in small towns and rural communities.
He points to a similar office that was created by state government in Kansas as a potential model that could work for the federal government. The group says Wisconsin's creation of a Blue Ribbon Commission on Rural Prosperity is another good example. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for Labor Radio, then at 6:30 it's Prison Pipeline, and at 7 it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow, we can expect sunny skies with a high of 85 degrees. Today in history, in 1928, the antibiotic penicillin is discovered by Sir Alexander Fleming. The young bacteriologist's accidental discovery led to one of the greatest developments of modern medicine. The quote of the day is from activist and author Angela Davis, who said, quote, "You have to act as if it were possible to radically transform the world, and you have to do it all the time." A federal judge has ordered the removal of acting director of the Bureau of Land Management, William Pendley Perry. Mark Richardson has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The Bureau of Land Management begins this week without a director. In a win for conservation groups in a number of western states, a federal judge ordered that William Perry Pendley be removed from his post, that he's been on the job illegally for more than 400 days without a Senate confirmation. Pendley was nominated in June to permanently lead the BLM, but his name was withdrawn in August. Aaron Weiss with the Center for Western Priorities says not only did Pendley's tenure exceed the statutory limit, but he named himself to the interim job, which also wasn't legal.
The judge spent a lot of time in his ruling going over just how absurd these series of succession orders were, signed by Secretary Bernhardt and signed by William Perry Pendley himself in his acting capacity, making that acting capacity permanent.
The court's finding is the result of a lawsuit brought by Montana Governor Steve Bullock. The agency says Pendley will immediately step down pending an appeal. There's no word yet on who might be his successor. In his ruling, Judge Brian Morris gave Montana's governor 10 days to submit a list of specific actions to be set aside. Weiss points out that while the ruling applies only to Montana, its impact could be far-reaching.
The immediate effect is going to be to overturn two specific resource management plans in Montana. My question is going to be the long-term effect, because if other governors or conservation groups point to this ruling and say, well, if it's illegal in Montana, it's illegal everywhere else.
Penley was controversial from his first day on the job. He'd been an oil and gas industry attorney, publicly doubted climate change, and headed a conservative foundation that called for the elimination of all public lands. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
Tribal plaintiffs claimed victory in a U.S. Census lawsuit. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Leaders of the Gila River Indian community and the Navajo Nation say they scored a victory in litigation to make sure there's a complete and accurate U.S. Census count. The tribes and other plaintiffs requested census operations continue through October 31st instead of the end of September. Last week, a federal court ordered the 2020 census count to continue until the end of October. Governor Stephen Ro Lewis, in a video message to his community, urged citizens to complete the census in September due to an appeal.
That could give us some more time for us to keep working to get our count up, but the United States has already appealed that ruling, and it may end up going to the Supreme Court. So a date extension is far from certain, and counting could come to an end as soon as September 30th. So we have to go by what we know. That we have until September 30th for anyone who has not completed the census to fill out their form.
The census was initially planned through October 31st, but in August, the Trump administration shortened the time, setting a new deadline in September. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez, in a statement, praised the ruling and said the pandemic has been a setback, creating many challenges to get people counted, especially in rural areas. As of Thursday, the Navajo Nation's response rate for the 2020 census was only 20.5%. 30% of Gila River Indian community members have not completed the census. This summer, the Census Bureau reported the national response rate was more than 60%. Last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia determined Alaska Native corporations are not tribal governments under the CARES Act and not eligible for funds. The ruling is a win for tribes, which sued over Alaska Native corporations getting a share of the $8 billion in CARES Act funds for tribes. Tribes, which filed the litigation and include some Alaska tribes, claim only tribal governments should be allocated CARES Act dollars. The court held that ANCs are not federally recognized tribes and include some of the largest and most profitable corporations in Alaska. An appeal is likely. The ANCs have the support of Alaska's congressional delegation. About $500 million in CARES Act funding remains for tribal governments. How it will be dispersed if tribal plaintiffs ultimately win is yet to be determined. Hopi Tribal Chairman Timothy Nuvangyuma is asking U.S. senators to reauthorize the special diabetes program for Indians. He testified virtually last week before the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. The Hopi tribe in Arizona has utilized the program for more than 20 years to provide diabetes prevention through education, fitness, and finding ways to address food insecurity. The community health approach also incorporates Hopi culture. The pandemic has impacted in-person services, which are now virtual.
We are currently offering a wide array of online fitness classes from Monday through Friday, including Native Fitness, which incorporates traditional Hopi song and dance. In addition, HSDP is hosting the Fitness Bucks Challenge, where participants earn fitness bucks by completing a virtual fitness class, classes that are held on the Hopi Wellness Center's Facebook page. The HSDP also modified two programs that celebrate the Hopis' longstanding tradition of running. The 28th annual 100 Mile Club event just wrapped up, and despite it being virtual, there were nearly 800 participants ages 5 and up.
Legislation introduced this summer seeks to reauthorize the special diabetes program for Indians for an additional 5 years and increase funding to $200 million per year. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A recent survey found that despite the onset of the coronavirus pandemic and economic crisis, the number of Americans that are passionate about addressing climate change is on the rise. Eric Galatis has more on the story with the Public News Service.
As the nation grapples with massive wildfires, a hurricane season already on its second alphabet, and intensifying drought, conservationists are calling on moderators for tomorrow's first presidential debate to press candidates for their plans to address climate change. In 2016, just one question referenced climate change during a town hall event, and Colin O'Mara with the National Wildlife Federation says this year's moderators need to chart a different course.
To not have a question is just the height of irresponsibility. We think that every American has a right to know what the candidates' positions are on these incredibly important issues that are affecting, you know, millions of their neighbors across the country.
O'Mara and others want USA Today's Susan Page, C-SPAN's Steve Scully, Fox News' Chris Wallace, and NBC News' Kristen Welker to ask President Donald Trump and Vice President Joe Biden for their plans to reduce emissions in electricity generation, in the transportation sector, in agriculture, and restoring lands to capture and sequester more carbon. The world's top scientists have warned that less than a decade remains to sharply curtail fossil fuel emissions to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. O'Mara says the next president will be charged with leading the nation out of the biggest financial downturn since the Great Depression, and addressing climate change full steam could create good-paying jobs in every community across the nation.
That's the opportunity to clean up existing sources of energy. It's the opportunity to deploy clean energy sources, to transform the transportation sector. We could create, you know, 10 to 12 million clean energy and kind of climate-related technology jobs.
O'Mara says the presidential and vice presidential debates don't have to be just a spectator sport. He's encouraging Americans who have been impacted by climate change to reach out to the networks and to remind journalists on their Facebook and Twitter pages to make sure climate change is part of this year's national conversation. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
Savannah residents are nurturing young trees in vacant lots. The trees will help replace those lost to storms and development. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Savannah, Georgia is famous for its trees. Graceful live oaks draped with Spanish moss shade many of its historic streets. The city's trees are not only beautiful, they provide shade, cool local neighborhoods, and help absorb stormwater. But many are disappearing.
We're losing trees to development and to major storm events.
That's Savannah's sustainability director, Nick Defley. He says that to help restore Savannah's tree canopy, the city is planting new trees. It recruited un- and underemployed residents to help transform three vacant lots into nurseries, where young trees can mature until they're ready to plant where needed.
So we now have these urban tree nurseries in low-lying, underserved communities, and they are being built up and beautified and designed and grown by folks from that community.
Defley says these local paid apprentices receive training, job placement, and an opportunity to become certified landscaping professionals.
We're focused on giving people skills to learn how to increase their economic mobility and get better jobs and take pride in the community that they live in.
All while helping create a skilled workforce that can maintain Savannah's beautiful trees for many years to come. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Lau. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, Eric Galatis, Mark Richardson, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio, where host DeMay Roberts presents Matter, written and performed by Charles Grant as a response to police brutality and gun violence inflicted on Black Americans. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our wonderful members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, where we'll be hearing a special rebroadcast of Jason Sherman's interview with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty on police reform. Stay with us.
So let's talk about Portland.
You have anarchy on one hand, and the
police are bracing for violence.
As hundreds of protesters marched peacefully through Portland this week.
Evidence of police shooting indiscriminately.
It's not racist.
No.
If you look at what's gone on in Portland, those are anarchists. If we didn't take that stand right now, you would have a problem like, you know, they were going to lose Portland.
Every weekend we seem to talk, things are getting worse.
Chaos in Portland over the weekend.
Men wearing masks, camouflage, generic police patches, detaining protesters, putting them into unmarked vans.
What's happening there now?
What happened in Portland over the weekend was not only unlawful and unconstitutional, it was just plain wrong.
Mayor of Portland, Oregon, has compared the scene in his city overnight to urban warfare.
Not good.
Police fired tear gas at protesters in Portland, Oregon.
Protests have shown no sign of slowing down.
Portland seeing yet another week of violence.
Breaking news now, the Oregon State Police have
a large and violent mob.
Hello, my name is Jason Shermans, and I am confused. I sit here recording this audio in my bedroom. I'm not able to go down to KBOO News to record this segment because of coronavirus. I'm also not able to leave my house, or I shouldn't leave my house, because wildfires are raging this weekend and the air is so filled with smoke that it is hazardous to breathe. And as I have just listened to that collage of news clips that I assembled, I am at a complete loss for even what to say and how to start this segment. There's so much going on in the world, and there's so much that is broken. I don't come to you with answers today, but I invite you to join me to try to come up with some solutions for this problem that we are facing in terms of policing in our community here in Portland, Oregon. Like I said, I don't have the answers, but I am searching for someone who does, and I decided that I would talk to the one person in my community that I have met that I think that I thought would have the answer, or at least be able to sort of point me in the right direction. So I called Commissioner Joanne Hardesty.
So let's dive into this. I'm interested in getting a little bit more of your history. I know that you've been very active in community in Oregon and around Portland for decades now. But I'm wondering if you consider your work in the community, activist work.
I consider myself a community organizer. I've always considered myself a community organizer.
As a community organizer, now that you are in government, do you know, right, has that limited your ability to organize the community as a member of the community? Do you feel that that has changed?
I think clearly being in an elected position changes the dynamic of the relationships. But all the skills I've acquired over the last 30 plus years in engaging community are skills that are absolutely critical to me doing my job successfully. And so, for example, if I'm passing a major public policy issue, I make sure community is engaged in the entire process, right, and helping to figure out what the problem is, what the solution is, and what the policy proposal should be. You know, that's a skill set that I think is unique in government, just in general, because that's not normally how government operates, but it's something I treasure quite a bit. I spent a lot of years banging my head against the wall at City Hall, right, as a community member, as an activist, trying to get changes to take place. And what I realized is that the system in which we operate just really isn't conducive for the most public engagement that we could get. And so with my office, we're committed to engaging people where they are. Before COVID, that meant that quarterly I was having meetings out in various communities because everybody can't make it to City Hall Wednesday morning at 9:30 to provide testimony. And so it's important to me that we create opportunities for the public to participate rather than expecting the public to participate in the very narrow traditional structures that we have in place.
So moving on, I want to talk a little bit about, you were in the Navy, right? How long were you in the Navy for?
4.5 years.
During your experiences, I'm sure you've seen and you experienced how rigorous the training can be. What does that rigorous training and discipline, what does that look like, and does that need to be applied more to our police officers? Is this maybe something that's missing in our police force in terms of training and discipline?
Well, let me just say that the way we train our current law enforcement all over the state, we train them as if they're going to war. So we need to train less for military skill sets, more towards skills that include communication, de-escalation, nonviolent responses to aggression or people with mental health issues. That's why I'm currently serving the governor's task force on the Department of Public Safety Standards and Practices to really look at how do we fundamentally change training from day one, because all law enforcement go to Salem for their first 16 weeks of training. And it's up to individual agencies to decide how much training they have after that. But I have provided training at DPSST, and I have observed training at DPSST. We train police to perceive the community as the enemy, and then we deploy them in communities all over the state with that mindset. A, personally, I don't think we've ever wanted that, but B, I don't think we've also ever had the opportunity to look institutional-wide at how policing happens in our state and our community.
So as we are talking about retraining and reorganizing our police to serve, I'm wondering what are some of the differences and needs that you might perceive between different communities and how they can be served that we should be thinking about right now?
Well, I'm thinking about what does community safety look like? And community safety is not reliant on responses to community social ills. When I look at over the last few years, over 50% of people arrested by Portland police, but for being houseless, would have never been arrested. That is a misuse of our criminal justice system, because poverty is not illegal. And so the fact that we use our jails as a stopgap, that is a misuse of public safety resources. And so we're starting a conversation around what does community safety look like? I can tell you that many of the calls that Portland police get are fear of people. Somebody looks suspicious. Somebody is talking to themselves, walking down the street. The police are not trained social workers. And so what may need a mental health response now gets a police response. What may need a social service response gets a police response. And it is because the police have taught the public to call them for all the social ills. We need to rethink that. So part of rethinking that is the Portland Street response. the whole goal of the Portland Street Response is to figure out how do we keep people as safe as possible where they are, right, with the limited resources that we have. I think once that program is up and operational and the community gets to see it in action, they will be thrilled at having a first responder that is not weaponized. That's what, when I did community surveys, when I interviewed houseless people, when we did focus groups, it was overwhelmingly that people need to be safe where they are, especially if they have nowhere else to go. And so police should never, ever be called unless there is a weapon involved or some real crime is taking place. And so we have to retrain the public. We have to retrain our new police force. And we have to create other first responders since we haven't changed that system since the early 1900s. And the only change we made then was paying first responders as compared to them being all volunteers.
That covers pretty well how we protect communities in general in Portland. But yeah. Specifically, are there ways, or let me ask this question, are the ways that we need to train police how not to react? Are police, for example, if they're called out to, someone calls in a suspicious person call in Northeast Portland versus someone calls a suspicious person in Northwest Portland, are they reacting differently to those two calls in negative ways?
That's a very good question. I would even go a step further and say, what is the description given of the unwanted person in Northwest? Because what we know is that Black people are stopped much more often in areas that they don't live in. So I would suspect a suspicious person who's African American in Northwest would get a more aggressive police response than a Black person in East Portland. The areas in the city of Portland where Black people traditionally are not in high numbers are areas with the highest arrest rates of Black people. And so my analysis says that, you know, it's because somebody has assumed you don't belong in that neighborhood.
When a police officer arrives, let's say in a Black neighborhood versus a white neighborhood, are there differences in the way that community is going to react? Are there differences in the way the Black community and the white community react to a police presence in their neighborhood? And how does that affect how the police should be responding when they arrive in that neighborhood or should be comporting themselves?
Well, I think everything depends on what officer responds and what their personality type is. I have seen officers respond to Black people who are smiling and who are relaxed and who are engaged in conversation. And I've also seen people be stopped and the police have their hands on their weapon before the window is even rolled down. Everything depends on that officer's perceptions of the call that they're on.
Right.
I also know that when community members have also been trained to make the call sound as scary as possible to get a quicker police response. For example, people will make calls and say, oh, somebody put up this camp across the street from my house, and they're doing drugs in it. Oh, I see a weapon, right? And so what they know is that the more excited and more dangerous they make it appear, the more likely there is they will get a police response. But let me also say that when we have another first responder system, the 911 call takers will be asking questions like, do you see a weapon? Do you see people involved in are they beating each other up, right? Like, what is going on at the scene? So we are, at this time, retraining 911 operators on some very specific protocol that will help us divert calls that shouldn't go to police in the first place.
So currently, and I'm sure extending into the coming months, we have all these protests nightly in downtown Portland. How should protesters expressing their civil right to free speech, how should they be handling the police? How should they be interacting with the police? How should they be handling being dealt with by the police when the police start to try to remove them?
I continue to be extremely frustrated with the fact of why are we sending 30 riot police out to guard a Portland Police Union office building. As you know, I am not the police commissioner. even though I have asked the police bureau be put in my portfolio many times, it has not happened. But I can say that it is not helping the current state of policing, the abuse that I see happening by a very small number of protesters against the police and a large number of police against peaceful protesters. It's totally, the response by police has consistently been over the top based on activities that they say a small number of protesters are involved in. The police are supposedly pretty well trained, which means if they don't know by now, the handful of protesters who are setting fires, who are attempting to assault the police, then they are not effective detectives and investigators. Right? If they can't figure that out by now. The fact that the response to a small number of people throwing whatever they throw at the police, whether it's water bottles or rocks, the fact that the response is to tear gas entire neighborhoods is way, way, way over the top. And so, again, my frustration is if I was in charge of police, they would be prohibited from showing up at protests. They would, and they would... allowed to show up in riot gear anywhere. So, you know, I remember leaving my house for a protest, and I had a gas mask and other tools so that if, when I was tear gassed, I would be able to help myself recover. And I thought to myself, what is wrong with the fact that
are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.